What is going on, friends? Welcome to My Weekly Mixtape, the show that takes the classic mixtape approach to building a modern playlist. I'm your host, Brian Colburn. Joining me tonight is author, journalist, and filmmaker Stephen Blush, who's known for such books as American Hardcore, American Hair Metal, When Rock Met Disco, and When Rock Met Reggae, among many others. He's here today to talk about his newest book, When Rock Met Hip Hop, which focuses on a topic that I'm a huge fan of, the fusion of rock and hip hop genres across the decades. Stephen, it's a pleasure to have you on the show, my friend.
I'm very glad to be here. And When Rock Met Hip Hop was a labor of love, and I'm really happy to share it with your audience.
Well, since you're a first-time guest, I'd like to start with the basics. What does the word mixtape mean to you?
Well, I certainly had made a lot of mixtapes in my day. It's an expression. It's more than just a bunch of songs put together. It's your personality coming out. I used to make tapes and give it to people, give them as gifts, because that was my expression of music and art on a cassette tape at that time. But I think the mixtape is a lost art that should make a comeback, and hopefully you could have something to do with that.
That's certainly the hope, my friend. We do it through playlists now, but my goal with the show is to try to bring back the thought process behind making a playlist, not just taking a bunch of songs, throwing them on there and hitting shuffle, because that's not quite the same sentiment.
Yep.
Now, your new book, When Rock Meets Hip Hop, follows, like I mentioned earlier, When Rock Meets Disco and When Rock Meets Reggae. Was this always intended to be the third entry for this trilogy of sorts?
This is a trilogy. I didn't intend to write a trilogy. I wrote When Rock Met Disco, and it just kind of... What I'm talking about is the cross-cultural crossovers of music. So when I'm talking about When Rock Met Disco, I'm not really talking about Do the Hustle or the Bee Gees and Saturday Night Fever. I'm really talking about when rock bands got in there and started making disco records. And it was very politically incorrect at the time. There was a whole thing called Disco Sucks, and people weren't having it. But the Rolling Stones, Miss You, and Kiss, I Was Made for Loving You, and Do You Think I'm Sexy by Rod Stewart, and Queen, and Blondie, they really brought a power to the music, because these were like touring rock bands that played 200 days a year. So it was a really great change in the music. I've always been a huge reggae fan, and I don't know how I ended up doing When Rock Met, but really what the impetus was. But it wasn't like, I wasn't looking to do a series, I would say. But when I talk about When Rock Met Reggae, I'm not really talking, while I do give a thumbnail sketch of the music of Jamaica, what I'm really talking about is when the Clash started doing reggae, and when the Police started doing reggae, and when Bob Marley did a song called Punky Reggae Party, where he's name-checking all these bands. So I'm talking about it was the cultural crossover. By the time I got to When Rock Met Hip Hop, yes, I was writing the third of the trilogy. And it was something that I personally had experienced living in New York City for all those years. I was a DJ at the clubs. I worked at a lot of the magazines, usually like kind of fashion magazines, like Andy Warhol's Interview magazine, things like that. Mm-hmm. And a few of them that are now deceased magazines, like Paper Magazine and Details Magazine, you know, if anyone knows their history with that stuff. But because I was a DJ, I had entree into these fashion magazines, like these edgy underground fashion magazines, right? So they were kind of rock and roll, basically, without being rock and roll. And because of that, I got opportunities to just start writing. I really had very little experience with it. And I chose the interview format. Interview magazines format was interviews. So for a very first interview I did was Harley Flanagan of the Cro-Mags. The second interview I think I did was Public Enemy. The fourth or fifth one was Anthrax. So I was just following what was going on with music.
And Stephen, this book isn't just tied to the origins of everything. This kind of covers the entire spectrum of rock meeting hip hop across the decades.
The rock met hip hop story starts with Blondie with the song Rapture. That's very early on, 1981. 1984, 85 is Run DMC with Rock Box and King of Rock. 1986 is the Beastie Boys with No Sleep Till Brooklyn with Kerry King from Slayer playing on it. 1986 is Rick Rubin, who worked with the Beastie Boys, hooks up the Unforeseen. Nobody thought it would work when he brought Aerosmith and Run DMC together into the studio. And it ended up being probably one of the most important records of the latter for the end of the 20th century. I know that VH1 called the video the most important video of the era, end of the 20th century. And it certainly was. I mean, the song is one thing, but the video is, it's literally breaking down the walls. That's what they're talking about. You know, yes. It's like they tear down the walls of this. And then they rock out, right? If you remember the video, that's how it works.
100%.
Yeah. And a classic, right?
Oh, undeniable.
And then what happens is there's a West Coast version of this, but it's coming from the rock side. And that's like rock bands rapping. And that was Red Hot Chili Peppers and Faith No More and House of Pain, Cypress Hill, and all of that culminating in Rage Against the Machine, where they're literally playing rap on guitar. They're scratching on guitar, singers rapping, but the rhythm section's playing rock. Right around that time is a hugely important record, which is the merger of Public Enemy, who were trying to be the Clash of hip hop. So they're coming with this really heavy intent, and they get together with Anthrax, and they do the song Bring the Noise. And the history of that song is Scott Ian of Anthrax was a huge fan of hip-hop. The whole band was, basically, because they grew up in the streets of the city. But Scott Ian, in particular, was a fan of hip-hop, and on the cover of one of these heavy metal magazines, he's wearing a Public Enemy shirt. And then Chuck D, in the lyrics on their second album, name drops Anthrax. Of interest, Public Enemy had done a song called She Watched Channel Zero. The song was basically rapped over a slowed down version of Slayer Angel of Death, which was a super important development. If you think about that one. So Anthrax, Scott Ian and Charlie Benanti had developed a friendship with Chuck D of Public Enemy. And like I said, Public Enemy had already recorded Bring the Noise. And they started hearing from Scott Ian that they wanted to do a collaboration of a rock rap version of that Bring the Noise. And it took Public Enemy quite a while to come around on that, because they were like, well, why are we going to re-record a song we already put out? You know, they didn't really get where Anthrax was coming from in terms of that. So back and forth, they tried to get the studio together. That didn't actually work. So this makes it different than Run DMC and Aerosmith, where they're actually in the studio together. What this ended up being was Public Enemy giving Scott Ian and Charlie Benanti the individual tracks, and they cut it all up. Like, you had to cut and paste back then, because we weren't yet in the digital age. And then they brought the sledgehammer guitars over it, and you had a whole new song. And that tour, 1991 and 1992, of Anthrax and Public Enemy was really a groundbreaker.
Oh, yeah.
It was really, really changed the face of music. And everyone was worried about, like, how the crowds would get along, because both crowds were so extreme. It was probably about 70% Anthrax fans and 30% PE fans. But everyone got along. Everyone was respectful. Everyone learned from each other. And it's a real changing point in the history of music. Right after that, going back to the West Coast, you have a soundtrack to a film called Judgment Night. And the Judgment Night soundtrack is super important, because it's all rock and rap bands meeting together. So it's House of Pain with Helmet. It's
Biohazard and Onyx.
Biohazard and Onyx. And it's Cypress Hill and Pearl Jam. And it's Ice-T's Body Count with Slayer doing a medley of songs by The Exploited.
Mm-hmm.
So you're really talking about the change in music happening there. And that opened doors for everyone. And this record was 1993. And then in 1994, Korn shows up on the scene. And you see the rise of what we now call nu metal. A lot of people bag on Limp Bizkit, but they quickly became part of the Hollywood scene. And the DJ was DJ Lethal from House of Pain.
House of Pain, correct.
That gave a legitimacy to their sound. And System of a Down have that hip hop flavor. Linkin Park, you got to put as part of it. Although they're the band I probably dislike the most of nu metal personally. But they've sold 60 million records, which is more than Led Zeppelin. So who am I to say? But that carries on till today. Limp Bizkit's still playing arenas with DJ Lethal, and all those groups connect to Method Man and Dr. Dre and Exhibit and all that stuff. There was a record called Loud Rocks.
Yes.
Which was a really cool record where it's new metal groups performing hip hop tracks. And I do a whole chapter of that in the book. And it's a super important time. So when rock met hip hop is not really a 10-year story like most people think. You know, it's not like 80s to 90s. It's really 80s till today. And I think the merger of rock and hip hop is here to stay.
Well, I want to remind people listening that you can hear a playlist of all the songs we're talking about tonight embedded on the episode page over at myweeklymixtape.com. Now, I want to take a moment to start diving into some of those songs you talked about, because you gave a great history there in that last question. So I want to go through a couple of those songs. You mentioned Run DMC and Aerosmith's Walk This Way. Now, even though Run DMC had already flirted with rock on tracks like Rockbox and King of Rock, the collaboration with Aerosmith is really what broke those barriers down. Literally, like you had said in your statement, mm-hmm. broke the walls down.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you feel this was the song that succeeded when others in the past didn't quite break through to the mainstream?
There's a few different points to that. I think a lot of it goes back to the legitimacy of Rick Rubin. I think you can't underplay that. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, Rick Rubin is responsible for 10% of the bands in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and 150 million of sales he's responsible for. And the other part of it was, culturally, people were more ready for it. And to redo, not to come up with a new song, but to redo Walk This Way, which is a song that everybody loved, I think that's really the magic. That's your 3 points. You can't mess with that. So I would say that everything comes down to time and place. And Run DMC, Beastie Boys, they kind of paved the way for this to happen. But, you know, you make a good point. You know, Run DMC did their songs, like the first album and the second album being the King of Rock album, the first album being with Rockbox. And it was a little bit too early. It was almost like people took it as novelty, but it wasn't novelty. It was from the heart.
Right.
So people had that wrong. And Aerosmith was ripe for a comeback. They had really fucked up, you know, between drugs and, I mean, the last record before that, when they got back with Joe Perry, was called Done With Mirrors, which is a reference to cocaine. You know, they were still like drugged out and fucked up. This put them back in the game. And people were ready for Aerosmith to come back. People were ready for what Run DMC were offering. And Walk This Way is just a classic. And Rick Rubin brought it all together. So I think that's why.
Let's stay on Rick Rubin for a second there, because he carried that same mindset with Run DMC and Aerosmith over to his work with the Beastie Boys. From early rock samples like AC/DC's Back in Black on Beastie Boys' Rock Hard and Led Zeppelin's The Ocean on She's Crafty.
Yep.
But Licensed to Ill, you had talked about it, Kerry King of Slayer, having him guest on No Sleep Till Brooklyn.
Yep.
How important was that collaboration in legitimizing hip hop music within the metal community?
Oh, it was everything. That's the whole thing. Because people didn't really get No Sleep Till Brooklyn. They couldn't really figure out what that song was about. So you have the situation where Rick Rubin is working in the studio in two different rooms. He's doing Licensed to Ill and Rain in Blood by Slayer. Two records which are just so iconic. You know, so important to each of its perspective genres. And of course, the story of Kerry King, instead of asking for points on the record, took $250. You know,
I'm sure he's reconsidering that one years later.
Yeah, he's like, he jokes about it, but you could tell it hurts. It's in the book as well, but I don't think he understood the Beastie Boys or the Beastie Boys understood him. Like, nobody really got it except for Rick. So, again, it comes back to Rick Rubin. But yeah, Kerry King gave it its legitimacy because he was from the most powerful band in the world, who comes out with this record that's like scary. I mean, everybody remembers the first time they heard Rated Blood. You know, there's not 1 second of a ballad or anything. It's just full on adrenaline. So, yes, the whole crossover to metal comes back to Kerry King.
And then we were talking about Anthrax earlier with their collaboration with Public Enemy on Bring the Noise. But years prior, Anthrax already had dabbled in the rap hip hop crossover as their song I'm the Man. They originally wrote to collaborate with the Beastie Boys, but that fell through. Do you feel like Anthrax had their finger on the pulse of where things were headed long before they got there? Because I feel like I'm the Man is one of those songs that introduced hip hop to the metal scene almost before Aerosmith and Run DMC introduced it to the mainstream.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. I mean, I'm the Man was a B-side, if I'm not mistaken.
It was an EP.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I'm the Man is a super important record. I think they were always, there was always a B-boy side to Scott Ian, I always felt. There's this 10-cent word called zeitgeist, and it's just about a feeling that's in the air. Like, everyone was just feeling rock and hip-hop. Nobody articulated it. Nobody said, oh, I'm going to mix rock with hip-hop. a lot of that has to do with, you have to go back to talk about musicians. Musicians aren't racial or racist. They hear a sound and they put their own twist on it. The great thing about when rock met hip hop is that it articulates the musical values of you just are merging music. It's not really black music or white music. You know, the musicians aren't thinking like that. But there was this feeling in the air that you were wanted to bring. Music had been very segregated before that. And people were really excited to merge these unique sounds and create something new. Because what the Beastie Boys or Anthrax or Aerosmith, it wasn't hip-hop on its own. It was hip-hop merged with their rock influences. So I would say that you have to look at it through that prism. I think that's really important.
Now, one thing I want to bring up here is a lot of the songs we've talked about so far involve the collaboration of artists. However, something that came from rock and hip-hop merging was sampling, which at a point, there was a very gray area around sampling. And I want to bring up Billy Squier's The Big Beat, because that song's been sampled over 300 times in hip-hop.
Yep.
How did that track from his 1981 album, even before The Stroke became the cultural phenomenon that it is, become such a foundational source for producers?
Yeah, The Stroke and The Big Beat. Those are basically foundational sounds. DMC from Run DMC says that Billy Squier and James Brown are the godfathers of hip hop, which is quite a statement, because I don't really have an answer for why. I mean, to be fair, Billy Squier is he's a good guitar player. He's got a couple killer songs, but in terms of his whole resume, he's a fair to middling rock star. He's not Led Zeppelin. You know, the one thing about his songs getting sampled is that they sample the drums, right? They're not really sampling his vocals. You know, they're sampling the drum beat. And that's
Only time I think they did his vocals was when Rick Rubin did Berserk Eminem. With Eminem.
Yeah.
And they brought in stuff from The Stroke.
Yeah, right. But that's the only one I could think of. I mean, there could be other songs where if there's 300 of them, I'm sure there's some songs that use that part. But really what the part was, it was the breakbeat. Every DJ was looking for the breakbeat. And the breakbeat of The Big Beat or The Stroke is unbelievably great. I mean, it's such an unbelievable sound. So I understand that. Bobby Trenard, when I interviewed him, he's passed away since, but he just talked about the simplicity of the drum set, the drum kit that he played. You know, he's not even playing cymbals. It's just, you know, a pounding beat. So I would say that that's the power of the beat. DJs are always looking for the break beat. Funky Drummer by James Brown and The Big Beat and The Stroke by Billy Squier are probably the best drum beats you could find.
And just a reminder to those listening out there, if you want to hear a playlist with all the songs we've discussed tonight, you could do so on the episode page over at myweeklymixtape.com. Now, earlier you talked about the Judgment Night soundtrack, which I consider to be one of the defining both rap rock moments as well as soundtracks of the 90s. I've gone on other podcasts to just opine about this soundtrack in and of itself.
Terrific. Yep.
How do you feel projects like this and the Loud Rocks album that you talked about earlier expand both artists' audiences beyond their core fan base, especially in the world of, let's say, an Onyx and a Biohazard? Because Onyx, as far as I was concerned, is a hip-hop group that brings rock tendencies to their sound. And Biohazard is a hardcore punk group that brings hip-hop tendencies to their sound.
Mm-hmm. So I think there's a magic of, similarly to the mixtape, a compilation album is an expansive experience, a chance to hear so many different musicians doing their thing. So I think there's always been really influential compilation albums. I think compilation albums speak to a deeper vocabulary of the music. I think that they have so many, you know, it's not just one group with a bunch of guests. It's 20 groups on an album, or, you know, whatever the number is. So there's a lot going on there. So I would say that that's probably the reason you have that, is because it's just such a deeper musical experience than listening to one group.
Now, obviously, we're just scratching the surface of the book tonight, but it would be a disservice if we didn't also touch a little bit on Rage Against the Machine and the emergence of nu metal as a genre, which you mm-hmm. talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are in 2026, and bands like Limp Bizkit, where there was a time that they kind of disappeared from the map, are resurging again. They're playing stadiums, opening for Metallica, playing arenas on their own. Looking into your crystal ball, where do you see those artists and the nu metal movement as the rap rock timeline continues to move forward?
Great question. I think if I knew that answer, I'd be a zillionaire. But I can't really point to anybody. You know, if the big four of heavy metal is Metallica, Megadeth, Slayer, and Anthrax, then the big four of nu metal would be Korn, Limp Bizkit, System of a Down, and Linkin Park. And I think what we're seeing now is, I mean, I guess Avenged Sevenfold, would they be considered part of that? I don't know.
I never really considered them nu metal. I think they leaned more punk and then kind of into the hard rock spectrum.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's kind of my point. I think what we've seen, we've seen this in all forms of music. Music is so much happened in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s that the world is now just catching up to it. So what you're seeing is the development of the individual bands of the individual genres today expanding their sound and becoming so much better at what they do. So I would actually say that really what you're seeing is, you know, Korn. I mean, I saw Korn very early because they used to open for Faith No More. I'd probably include the Deftones with that, I guess, right? Would you include the Deftones? Right. So maybe they're really not in the book, and I don't have a answer for why they're not. So kind of my apologies to the Deftones for that, because they've really developed their sound. Korn have really developed their sound.
I mean, Korn used to tour with Sugar Ray back in the day when Sugar Ray's first album, Lemonade and Brownies, was a rap rock hybrid album. And then when Fly took off, they kind of pivoted to more pop sounds, but people don't realize that Sugar Ray started as a rap rock outfit.
Oh, sure they did. And I can't remember the name of their DJ, but he went on to work with a lot of these groups too. I hung out with Sugar Ray during the period you're talking about, before Fly. But the development of Deftones and the development of Korn and the development of Limp Bizkit. I mean, DJ Lethal from House of Pain. I mean, come on. That just takes it to a whole nother level. And he you could tell he's driving that bus right now. And it's kind of hard to even talk about Linkin Park because they're just coming out with a new singer and all that kind of stuff. So it's a little too early to judge them. But I think those are the points that matter. That's the future too, because I don't see too many new bands coming from that world, but they're all getting better and they're all getting more interesting, and that's okay by me.
I have a prediction that the cycle of the early 2000s nu metal scene is doing the cyclical turn where a lot of younger bands are going to start looking to that as motivation for new sounds. As I've been hearing a lot of younger up and coming bands that are starting to touch on the new metal aspects of the early 2000s in their music now, but taking it to a new place. Whereas the Linkin Parks and the System of a Downs are your almost legacy acts. And there's up and coming bands that are now taking that style into new areas where it's never been before.
So who are these groups though? I mean, I know intellectually who they are, but I don't actually know who. I couldn't name a group.
There's a group out now called Aurora Wave that's taking reggae and metal and mixing it together, which I find very interesting.
Nice.
Because that's going back to one of your other books, but within reggae, there's always that element of delivery of hip hop when you listen to groups like the Dirty Heads that take reggae and hip hop and kind of merge them together. Aurora Wave is taking metal and reggae and hip hop and kind of merging it into a sound. And that's one of the examples I have.
Okay, that's good. I'll check them out. But yeah, I'm looking for those groups for sure. And I'd like to know that. But yeah, I think these legacy acts, which is an excellent way to put it, are paving the way for a new generation of this. Absolutely.
Steven, this has been an extremely insightful conversation. Where can people learn more and pick up a copy of When Rock Meets Hip Hop, as well as connect with you?
Sure. I have an Instagram page, The Steven Blush. I have stevenblush.com. You could certainly email me there. I welcome all communications. The When Rock Met Hip Hop book just came out. I'd love for you to get it. If I see you, I will sign it for you wherever I am. It is available at every independent record store. Although I would honestly, I know this is sacrilege, but fastest and cheapest is through Amazon.com. It's less money for me, but I'd rather you have the book.
Well, Steven, I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me tonight on My Weekly Mixtape.
Okay, it was really a pleasure. I appreciate it, Brian.
And to those listening, remember, you can hear all the songs we've discussed in tonight's episode, as well as check out the entire back catalog of the show over at myweeklymixtape.com. If you'd like to connect with the show on social media, you could do so on all the haunts at myweeklymixtape. If you'd like to become a part of the Mixtaper community, you could do so over at patreon.com/myweeklymixtape. It's free to join. And there are several tiers available if you'd like to support the show a little bit extra. If you're listening to the show on Spotify, Apple Music, or on YouTube, please leave a 5-star review, give a thumbs up, drop a comment, do all the things, and help me reach other music fans with the show. Once again, my name is Brian Colburn. This has been My Weekly Mixtape. And until next time, enjoy the tunes.